Hey, what's going on? Welcome to the Mile High Five podcast. I'm Doug Cunnington, and today it's a collaboration episode I recorded with my friend Bill Yount over at the Catching Up to Five podcast. So we kind of just jump into the conversation because we're publishing it on each of our feeds. So that's why we don't have the normal intro and we kind of go back and forth. Just wanted to give you a heads up on that. Really fun to record with Bill. We've known each other for several years and just haven't scheduled the time until recently. So really excited to get this episode out to you, and be sure to check out Bill's pod over there on Catching Up to Five. Thanks. Bill, I'm excited to chat with you. We have crossed paths many times at different events over the last several years. I was looking back to see like when we exchanged emails and such. And yeah, I've known you for a few years, and I'm shocked that it took us this long to be able to have this conversation here. So I was thinking that we could talk about some mistakes that we've made along the way. And the stories about success are really fun. The fastest way to reach FI and maybe the most exact, perfect way to do it. But that's not really achievable for a lot of people, especially if you've already made a lot of mistakes. And I think you could learn a lot from other people's mistakes. And that's what we're going to talk about today. So I'm pumped. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Doug. And I want to say it's been a long time coming, but you're the Mile High Five podcast. We've seen each other along the way. Somehow we've missed being on each other's shows. And this is a collaborative show where it's a conversation where I ask you and you ask me, and we wander through our mistakes and maybe how we recovered. Because as we know, the perfect is the enemy of the good enough. And we may all strive to be perfect and over-optimize, but we're going to stumble, we're going to fall. And that's how you grow, learn, iterate. And we have both recovered from mistakes and still got to FI. So I think that's the important theme here today.
And I want to intro you a little bit, Bill. So you're one of the hosts and one of the co-founders for Catching Up to FI, one of the hugely popular shows that really blew up in the last, well, since you started it. And I just want to give you a chance to introduce yourself to the folks that may not know the show or not know you, Bill.
Yeah, well, thanks. I'm Bill Yount. I'm an emergency physician who screwed up his money until age 50. I didn't know what a net worth was. I wasn't tracking expenses. I wasn't budgeting. I was paycheck to paycheck on the hedonic treadmill of life and in the rat race. And at 50, I woke up, and everybody has a wake up at some point, but I woke up late as far as I'm concerned. You know, I got sued in my practice and I wanted out. I couldn't get out. I was burned out. And that happens to a lot of us for one reason or another. There's usually a shock to the system. And so, you know, I'd done everything wrong and did the AUM advisor and didn't manage my money. And I don't even know what our starting point was, net worth or anything. But in 10 years, making a significant, you know, iteration, inversion, and change transformation. We got to FI by my age 60, and recently I did transition into what I call the fog of FI, which is the fear of getting out. But I'm proud to say I'm a semi-retired, part-time emergency physician who loves podcasting. I started Catching Up to FI 3.5 years ago with Becky Heptig, and a shout out to her for helping me get started. 2 years ago, I brought on Jackie Cummins-Koski. Great decision. We've had a ball speaking to late starters of any age who feel like they're late. It could be a 30-year-old. It could be a 50, 60-year-old. In some ways, we all are late starters because we may not get it right in our 20s. And the memes and clickbait people that retired at 30, 35, 40 predominate in the space. And the average American, the silent generation, the lost generation, in my mind, is a late starter. And so I think we have a huge audience, which is potentially infinite. We have grown, and we're very proud of it. There was no voice for these people. I had contemporaries retiring in their 50s, and I was just getting started. So I felt lost, alone, shame, regret, remorse, anger. But you work through those emotions, you get your plan together, and I thought it was going to take 15 years. It took 10.
And congratulations on that, especially, like you said, you felt a lot of emotions when you felt like you were a little behind. And I think this show is and maybe it's exactly like sort of your purpose. You serve in your profession for all those years. And I feel like catching up to Phi, like you're really trying to help people. And as I see the show growing and I see you speaking at different events, you're really like serving that purpose of helping people out. And I don't know if we're going to get that deep into it today, but that's something where I don't feel like I have as big of a purpose. I'm just kind of floundering around, which kind of makes sense when you look at some of the mistakes that I've made. But I want to commend you, Bill, and I encourage folks from the Mile High Phi audience to check out your stuff, because I think that that service piece is really important and it gives you a really good guiding light, like moving forward as you, you know, leave the old life in the hospital, right?
Yeah, I mean, exercising the right side of your brain, your creative muscles. I mean, it really opens up a whole new world. And the best part about it is the community. Like yourself, I mean, 90% of my friends might be in the community now. It really blew open the possibilities in life. But before we get any further, my audience may not know exactly who you are. So give me the 5-minute bullet on Doug Cunnington, where he came from, how he ended up here as a podcaster, retired, and a bit about your journey so they understand it's a little different.
I came in really a little bit sideways, so I'll try to place the context and a little bit of a timeline. I had a corporate job for about 10 years or so. Didn't love it. It was in IT project management and management consulting. Think like the Bobs from Office Space, kind of like those guys. And I didn't love it, but I was trying to climb the corporate ladder. And along the way, in around 2013 or so, started dabbling with some side hustles online, building websites, different pieces of online marketing, and really kind of got obsessed with it. And it was very interesting learning new things. And along the way, I got laid off. So about 2015, I got laid off after kind of deciding that we could move wherever we wanted. I just moved and then called my boss and told them that I moved to Montana from the Atlanta area. They laid me off shortly after that. So that was kind of interesting, but it gave me an opportunity to grow my business. So I was an entrepreneur for about 10 years. I guess I'm still technically a small business owner, but I've really kind of shut that down over the last few years. And that is how I got into podcasting and YouTube. However, in around 2014, so jumping back, my wife and I calculated our net worth for the first time. We'd been married for 5 years at that point, and she had things put together a lot better. And I kind of, what you described, I kind of spent what I had, and we had separate finances and no kids. So at some point, we had a family finance meeting. We realized that we were actually investing more effectively and better than our individual advisors. So in 2014, we fired our advisors and started indexing and didn't really pay attention. I actually ended up on Mr. Money Mustache's website, and we learned about indexing. And then funny enough, Bill, I never read any of the other posts there. It was all right there. All the early retirement information was right there. But I didn't pay attention. And we just put our head down, kept working. And then we blink a few years later, we ended up moving to Longmont, Colorado, which is where Carl and Mindy Jensen live. That's where Pete, Mr. Money Mustache, lives. And I ended up meeting the crowd here. So I was kind of in a parallel path on the entrepreneurship side and, you know, a creator, and ended up meeting all the folks in the Phi community around here. And Carl and I hit it off. We ended up starting this show, Mile High Phi, together. And that's when I really got into the Phi stuff. And by then I had already realized that I didn't want to keep growing my business. I wanted to taper down, and I felt like I understood what enough was. And by, I would say, 2020, I started doing about 20% less work each year in my own business. I quiet quit on myself. And then at this point, I'm just doing the show where I get to have great conversations with people like you. And it's just listener supported. There's no sponsors. So it barely pays for hosting and software. I know you know the expenses that pop up. So My wife retired about 2 years ago in 2024, and that's how I ended up here, just kind of by accident. We ended up moving to Longmont and getting mixed up with the whole fire crowd.
Yeah, I mean, you live in the middle of the cult and the world capital of Phi, really, which is interesting. I've never made it to Longmont. That is a pilgrimage that I will one day have to make.
Let me know when you're around. Yeah, we'll have a whole thing going on. So yeah, it's really amazing. And the people that actually just like pass through town for the pilgrimage to stop by and hang out at the Phi Collective, or we just had, I think there were five Camp Phis in Colorado Springs, which is, it's a couple hours away, but if you're in Colorado, you may as well swing by and check it out.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like, what, you started your journey at what age?
Technically, it would have been 35.
Okay, so. And then the journey finished for you at what age then?
It's a little fuzzy, but I would say like 43 or something like that.
Wow, so an 8-year trajectory and the wind down. You know, kudos. I mean, we tell our audience, though, you know, if they put their heads down, like you say, and really get intentional with elevating income, decreasing spending, increasing the gap, investing the difference, they could do it in 10, 12, 15 years. So it's imminently possible, and you prove it too.
Thanks. And I agree. I mean, when I look back, I mean, we had great market returns over those years, of course. And
Yes, we did.
I cannot discount the luck. I mean, we're the luckiest people in the world, right? I mean, we're going to go over the mistakes, but in spite of all the dumb ideas that I had and all the mistakes that I made, things worked out fine. And I think as long as it's not a super catastrophic mistake, it can feel pretty bad in the moment. And we'll go over some of those where I think both of us were like, how am I going to recover from this? This is pretty dramatic. But it turns out if you do most things right most of the time, the compound interest does kick in this case.
Yeah, I mean, one of the great things about being human is we are incredibly resilient. We want to get out of survival mode and we want to thrive. We want to all live our, quote, best life, end quote, whatever that means. And I have some thoughts on how to engineer or a balanced life. And I hope to talk about them at Camp Phi in the near future. But, you know, I made a bunch of mistakes to get to the late start. And my mistakes didn't stop after I woke up. I mean, I still made a series of mistakes in the path to Phi. And we should talk about the pre-wake-up, the post-wake-up, the foundational money scripts that led to these mistakes. I mean, mistakes are a part of life. And if you don't fall down, skin your knees, dust them off, and get up, you haven't learned anything. Mistakes are the genesis of growth and education. So, you know what? I encourage people to make mistakes, just not with big numbers.
Right. Well, why don't you kick it off, Bill? And I like your format of like pre and post. We have so many that we may not be able to tell all of them. So we'll try to prioritize. But yeah, why don't you kick it off?
I mean, the first mistake is a very common one where, and it wasn't really my mistake as much as accepting a lack of conversation and knowledge transfer, generational wisdom transfer. My parents didn't talk about money with me. They just didn't. It was, you know, radio silence and crickets. I didn't know what they did, how they did it. There was a lot of self-parenting involved here, which was inadequate because I didn't know my blind spots and I didn't know what I didn't know. And I did not get taught the language of financial literacy, either formally in school or informally at home. And that carried on through till I was 50, basically. You know, it didn't happen in high school, college, med school, even residency. And I think these institutions honestly have an obligation to teach this language. They may teach economics and macro and microeconomics, but in the end, personal finance is a worldwide universal language. And I call out all institutions, all families. It isn't just English or Spanish. It's the language of financial literacy that needs to be embraced. Get rid of the taboos. Get naked with your money, because you won't learn unless, number one, you get the theoretical base. But that has to, it can't just be in school. It has to translate into actionable, clicking on the keyboard, making trades, learning about credit scores, mortgages, debt management. You've got to fumble through it and not just let somebody do it for you. And then we'll talk about advisors at some point too.
Mm-hmm. So you didn't have the foundational knowledge. So did this translate like pretty immediately to maybe not saving much, not thinking about the retirement time frame? Can you maybe give us a bullet list of some of the specifics that manifested because of the lack of foundation?
Oh, I mean, the fundamental lack of foundation was I didn't know the difference between needs and wants.
Okay. You know,
everything was a want, and it flips the script where you spent on your wants and then you covered the bills on your needs. You spent first, saved last. And, you know, just like Charlie Munger says, you got to invert that script. And it's a natural ingrained script, comes biochemically from our brains. And we have to educate ourselves against those natural inclinations that we have. And then one thing that happened in my 20s, where I lost my 20s completely to finance and early compounding in that, because I had prolonged education, lived as the poor student, hand to mouth, amassed $30,000 of credit card debt because I deserved vacations that I couldn't afford. And then, you know, in residency, you know, back in the day in the 90s, I got paid $25,000 a year and you got $1,000 raise a year. And somehow I managed to live in Chicago on that back in the 90s. It's hard to believe and what inflation has done to things. But you're sacrificing a shit ton of time for really low reimbursement. So it's like being education poor, like being house poor, where, yeah, you're going to elevate your income eventually, but you give up your 20s. And then guess what? You come out of residency with so much pent up consumption demand, so much pent up dopamine hit need. I mean, it's just like, then it becomes instant gratification and lifestyle inflation city because your income spikes pretty significantly. And all of a sudden you become a high income professional from being a poor student. And if you don't know how to partition your very first big boy or big girl paycheck and pay yourself first, figure out a lifetime savings rate that gets you to financial freedom, I would say in 20 years, because that's when mastery is tapering and burnout hits, and you want to be work optional. You don't want to necessarily retire and go cold turkey, but you don't want to have to be there. You want optionality, choice, time freedom back, where you control what you do and not the consumption industrial complex. So, the delayed gratification, the pent-up demand, the spike in income is just like a setup for failure. It just is a setup. And that's the culture I lived in. People say, yeah, you earn six figures or more, you're a high income doctor, but big money, big debt, late start, you're in a hole, $750 million as a new physician between student loan debt and mortgage debt and consumer debt. And you got to dig out of that hole. You are way behind. And people don't realize that. Doctors have immense financial stress and are locked into doctoring and high income for years, potentially longer. It's a 30-year trajectory, not a 20-year trajectory sometimes if you don't get it right from the front end. So it's not necessarily a mistake, but not being counterculture, not, you know, like the FI community is, where they recognize that money is power, it's potential energy, and I've got to trade my time and energy for cash that I convert into investment capital so that I create that engine that frees me from, you know, the active income engine.
All right. It's a big one to take in.
Sorry. I could be a little loquacious, as Jackie says, but let's flip the script and ask you, what were the foundational things that may not have been your mistakes per se, but you see mm-hmm. as mistakes that are, say, cultural, societal, that you succumb to unknowingly, unintentionally?
For sure. And I'll do a twofer, because I actually have a specific one around the 20s are a good time to look at. And Number one, I think I had friends who seemed to have credit card debt. And I kind of remember asking, like, how much do you have a car payment? Like, how much is it? Like, how much does your apartment cost? Like, I was trying to get a gauge, and they were my close friends, so I would ask, but it was all over the place. And a lot of times it was like, well, yeah, I have a whatever at the time in the early 2000s, it may have been a $500, you know, car payment or something like that. And I saw myself like trying to keep up, and I'm like, oh, so actually if I have a, maybe a little smaller car payment than that, then that'll be a better decision. But I found myself just like everyone, like trying to figure it out. And then seeing my peers, again, I was in management consulting, so people had relatively high paying salaries and maybe small chips on their shoulder. And they wanted to like show how successful they were by the, you know, consumption just in general. And in that job, I worked with a, I won't say anything too derogatory specifically, but I bought a whole life insurance policy at age 24 because I was referred to Northwestern Mutual and a financial advisor there. So all that is factual. I was suggested by my friend, like, hey, I met with this guy. He's pretty nice. He helps me with some investments. So I was like, this seems like a step in the right direction. Turns out, insurance salesmen typically just sell insurance. So that is the hammer that they try to hit everything with. On the plus side, they also got me to start a Roth IRA. So In parallel, I made a poor decision and got a whole life policy at age 24. And I kept it around, if you could believe this, but I kept it around until like 2 or 3 years ago because I had that sunk cost. And I was like, if I keep it long enough, it'll actually be an okay investment. Poor way to look at it. It just meant that I did not lose money on it. It was just like a very horrible opportunity cost. Like if I would have invested that in the market, it would have been whatever, 20x, whatever it was, but it turned out okay. And it's a good, valuable lesson to teach other people. Very rare is a whole life policy a good idea. There's just a very small number of people where that works out. But the other good thing that I did around that time frame, for a couple years, I did max out my 401k. So at the time, that was probably like $17,000 a year or something like that, which I was like, it doesn't seem like a ton. And I was like you said, I was living as a poor college student. So I was like, you know what? I'm making good money. And if I invest whatever, 20, 25% of my salary, then that's not a big deal. I've been living on way less. So, but yeah, the biggest mistake was that whole life policy in the 20s, but yeah, you had one too, right?
Yeah, exactly. I probably had the same salesman of the traditional milkshake sucking financial services industry, which still owns about 90% of the marketplace, and which why, you know, in our community, people have a very bad opinion of financial advisors, which I think is changing. But anyway, yeah, the only lecture I got on quote-unquote personal finance in med school was a grand rounds with a Northwest Mutual agent who, masquerading as a financial advisor, functionally a commissioned salesman, who was recommended by the residency, which was not a fiduciary thing that the residency did at all. And this is a very traditional story across all high-income professionals, and especially doctors. They didn't pay any attention to how they were educating their residents with life lessons. It was all medical education. But at any rate, yeah, sold me the big whole life insurance policy, got me into a crappy disability insurance policy that wasn't own OC with the right riders. And so, yeah, and these are sunk costs for sure, but they're also opportunity costs lost, because if you get term life and invest the difference, you do incredibly well. I was sending his kids to college instead of my kids to college, per se, with a, you know, 30% upfront commissions. And then it takes a long time to recover your capital, let alone there's like only a 3, 4, 5% return. And then even worse, when we were renovating a house later, and we can talk about that mistake, we got to the point where we needed more money. So I sold the whole life insurance policy, which is the worst way to disposition it. I mean, you can 1035 these things into an annuity so you can recover some ability to have floor income. But so I did. Not only did I get it, I got rid of it the wrong way just because I needed the cash to put into a really expensive rehab. And so there was that, and then the insurance piece, and then the debt piece. You know, one of the first mistakes we seem to all make is pulling future consumption forward into debt and not spending and saving intentionally. And then we dig a hole that you hear very commonly in our community that we have to dig out of in our wake-up call. People talk about $30,000, $50,000, $100,000 of credit card debt. So this is a universal mistake. Whole life may not be, but they definitely hit up the higher-income professionals for these policies for sure.
I'm jumping around a little bit, but you mentioned just having an advisor, and you mentioned that you had an AUM advisor. And I think, like you said, in the FIRE community, I think some people are realizing that an advisor can help point out blind spots. I think that's one of the most valuable things, and provide another set of eyes from a professional level. I mean, like we talked before, Bill, you and I know a ton of people, very smart people in the FI community that could maybe look over our spreadsheets, but there is a different relationship when you hire a professional that has certifications and they have the fiduciary responsibility to look at your balance sheet and give you advice. And it may not be perfect advice, because usually there's just a matter of trade-offs. There's no perfect solution. For example, from like a tax perspective, you're going to have to figure out if you're going to pay now or later, kind of thing. But overall, I think being able to work with an advisor really helped us have the confidence in our plan and to make sure we saw all those blind spots. Again, I'm jumping around, but can you talk a little bit about the working with an advisor in the past and how it looks for you now?
Yeah, that same salesman, insurance salesman, broker, traditionally masqueraded as an advisor, an AUM 1% or more than 1% fee, and we had low savings at that point. So it was a pretty big number, and it continues to be a big number that compounds against you. And as we well know, what you don't spend ends up back in your pocket and can grow for you. And we think 1% isn't much, but over time, that ends up being hundreds of thousands of dollars. And then, you know, those fees, the interest rates on credit cards, all these things where you're paying somebody interest as opposed to collecting interest, and they compound against you. It's a huge opportunity cost thing. And I got rid of, the first thing we did when we took back our money at 50 was fire the advisor, like you did. But we had one, you know, it was Northwest Mutual first, and then we were in a private bank, JP Morgan, where we had a meeting once a year. They show you these colorful pamphlets. Oh yeah, we got this and that and everything, your money. And they're on all these expensive, actively managed funds that are proprietary to JP Morgan. You weren't in the low cost, low expense ratio, passively indexed funds really at all. Double, triple whammy there. You know, you could call it things house poor or debt poor. We were advisor poor and weren't investing the difference there that we could have done on our own. But guess what? I took back my money and I DIY'd it traditionally for 10 years. That was an expense that we didn't, like, just like taxes, that I didn't want to pay. I wanted that advisor money to go into my pocket. So I was my own advisor. And as we'll talk about, I made mistakes in being my own advisor, but I still got there. And as I was exiting the building and moving towards the transition to FI, I promised, because I was not a spreadsheet guy. I was a rule of thumb and backwards budgeting guy, as you may have talked about, where as long as I saved 40% first, I could spend the rest. So I didn't really worry about it. But I knew that I needed somebody to get very granular with my numbers. And so at age 60, about 10 years in, I promised myself that I would do a retirement readiness checkup. Basically, I would finally go to the primary care physician. And with regards to the advising world, you know, CFP, fiduciary advisors, flat fee, well, they're the primary care physicians. Would you manage your own healthcare? Really? Would you? You can't prescribe yourself stuff. You're not going to see your blind spots. You need a healthcare coach, really, who's watching out for you in a fiduciary, Hippocratic oath way. And that's what we're looking for in advisors, a primary care physician, financial physician, wealth care instead of health care. And then so I re-entered the space, but I had to be pretty fluent in the language of financial literacy to know what the blind spots were and the nuances of the advisor I wanted that fit my circumstances, my situation. And so once in the community, I had a lot of networking ability and I asked for advice from people and I had a list of names. But then I also, because I had a specific way I wanted to have my portfolio managed, I wanted somebody that was a life planner and heard about George Kinder and was both the life planner and the financial planner. I wanted somebody that had tax expertise, for example, which is really important in retirement. So I wrote like a really long paragraph query and put it into Claude. And because I couldn't easily find this person because it was really a unicorn, especially because of the portfolio structure I wanted. And then up popped this guy, an independent RIA who had exited the traditional financial services industry for principled reasons because he wanted a lifestyle practice for his young family where he was 100% fiduciary with his clients all the time. And he was unbelievably low cost compared to the average cost and great service, great value for the money. And what I've told people is I had three questions for my financial wellness checkup. One, could I get rid of disability insurance because I wanted to shed that crappy Northwest Mutual policy? Two, could I get rid of life insurance because were we self-insured? And three, how close was I to FI? Well, the answer came back to all three of those. You can get rid of those two insurance policies and you are FI. So I was shocked. And the interesting thing was the cost of the insurance policies was more than the cost monthly of having him. So I view my advisor as an insurance policy. I view him as an asset. And as you said, blind spots, cognitive decline, protecting your spouse who may not be interested in finances and DIY from your own demise. So it really is a disability or life insurance policy in the end that the advisor replaces when you're FI. And then there's lots of other reasons, like you said, the blind spots and the nuances. And there's a lot of balls in the air when you retire. And how do you optimize? Do you really have the bandwidth or do you really want to take the bandwidth to worry, emotional bandwidth to worry, and then tactical, technical expertise to get it right without over-optimizing? And then when I step back and handed the reins off to him as the pilot of the operation. Now, I'm the co-pilot. I know exactly what's going on. It's not a blind handoff. And if he had to step away, I could take over. That's only in an emergency.
Right. And with your advisor, do you execute the trades? Let's say you're rebalancing whenever you do that annually or whatever. Do you execute the trades which he has told you, or does he actually do the trades where he's managing?
Yeah. He uses the newer custodian Altruist, which is the most fiduciary custodian out there and low cost to the advisor and low cost to the consumer. And I think Altruist is very tech forward. It was founded in 2018, 2020. The independent RIAs are flocking to this because they're the vanguard of the custodians taking on the Fidelities, Vanguards, and Schwabs of the world. And just watch out. Altruist will become to custodianship for RIAs what Vanguard became to the individual investor. I see it coming. So he uses a very tech-forward program, platform, and very efficient. He uses Monarch Money, which I used, and there was a seamless upload of all of our finances and budgeting and expense tracking. He uses AI in his own practice to create dashboards for checking in on our net worth and expenses and spending over the course of the year. I basically have unfettered access to him because he wants to take care of his clients and doesn't really limit the access to him, which is nice. And he limits the number of clients he has to like 50 or 60. He doesn't want to overextend himself. And he's 35. That's one thing people forget about. I want one advisor for 30 years. or 20 or 30 years. I don't want to get turnover within a practice. And these are nuances people don't think about. So I'm very happy. And I think that more hyper-optimized, frugal, over-savers, underspender, bogle heads, or five movement people should really evaluate the advisor as an asset. And it's a low-cost asset. I mean, it's okay to DIY. You do you. Everybody does themselves. But eventually, I don't think everybody DIYs as you go through the, you know, go-go, slow-go, no-go years. And there's a lot of risk as you age, even fraud risk, you know, being scammed, which my mom has been scammed a couple of times. I can make a good argument for advisors, but it isn't for everybody. I agree.
And I think I'm not going to repeat everything that you said, but I agree with you in a lot of ways. I think the one I'll emphasize is like the blind spots. Like, you don't know what your blind spots are, like, by definition. So it's good to have someone take a look. The other thing, like you said, it's not for everybody, but basically, like, when you're starting to face decumulation, that's a time where there's more tax implications, where mistakes like we're talking about today can actually cost you a lot more. Accumulating, that's a lot more straightforward. Like, get pointed in the right direction. You can kind of keep your head down. But when you start selling, you need to know what buckets to pull from. Do you have enough buckets? Do you need to start moving some money over to a Roth or some other mechanism? So depending on what you have going on, you need to look at it a little closer, obviously. Both of our audiences are probably fairly aware. If you have all of your money in your pre-tax, like 401k or IRA, and you're 35, you're going to have to figure out how to get some money in the meantime before things open up. Sure, you could take a 10% penalty, but probably there's a smarter, better way to do it.
DIYing is imminently, with financial accumulation, is imminently possible. I would still push back a little bit and say one of my dreams, along with a flat fee financial advisor who caters to early and mid-career physicians, is that every physician leaves residency or fellowship with a written financial plan and a lifetime savings rate based on the snapshot of their finances at that time. And I think everybody that's starting out their financial lives would benefit from that. Get yourself set up with a foundation. And this is where the hourly advice comes in. You don't have to have a long-term relationship, but at major transition points in your financial life, it's okay to run big decisions like buying a house, getting ready for college. When the big numbers come up and it's hundreds of thousands of dollars, hey, why wouldn't we have a financial advisor look at it and say, well, that's too much house for you. You should buy lower so that you can retire earlier and help with the nuances. So yeah, start out your life with one. And actually, another advantage of our financial advisor is we're having our kids meet with them. And it's sort of a family approach because it's a little bit emotional to talk to us about money. And I'm a big lecturer and my kids don't want to hear it from me. And they may be afraid to ask questions. Just like you go to a therapist to talk about the things and all the reasons you hate your parents. You can go to a financial advisor to talk about all the numbers that you don't want to tell your parents. And then you can have a non-emotional, impartial, educational opportunity, strategy and tactics, and guiding through not only the theory, but the actionable items. And so we want them to meet with them now, they're 27, and then occasionally when they have questions. And that's part of the financial benefits of being in our family. That's a benefit that we extend to our kids and is a value for us. And, you know, just like giving them early that they can compound, there's a lot of values we have helping the 20-somethings in our lives get started when there's a lot of demands, a lot of accounts, but very little income to put everywhere. So, and an overwhelm that they need to work through. So, I would just encourage people to avail themselves of professional advice for big decisions.
I want to make sure we hit a few of the big mistakes. So I'm gonna give another two. I'm gonna put two together here, and then we'll see where we go. But I was just thinking. I was like, man, I knew it was gonna be a good one, Bill. We could just talk for hours. We could do like a side podcast where we just hop on, see what comes up. But all right, I'm gonna get to a couple right here. I bought a house in 2005 at the height of the market, and I was thinking, you know, this is a great move. I actually got advice that I've heard other people say, like, oh, you know what? You should get as big of a house as you can, because you're probably going to earn more money, and go ahead and extend yourself and go big. Now, luckily, I didn't take that advice exactly, but I bought at the height of the market, and I was planning on making it a rental house after I moved out of there sometime in the future, indeterminate. And I kind of house hacked. So I had a roommate, one of my friends from college, and then I proceeded to blow all that money on alcohol and eating out. And I don't know what I did with it. It was like, I had a blast. It was super fun, but I didn't do anything with he was paying me like half the rent or half the mortgage as his rent. And I blew it all. Like I said, it just evaporated. Now in hindsight, after reading Die with Zero, I'm like, that could have been the right move at the time, because I had a blast. I had a little bit of credit card debt and I was kind of goofing up. Now, I got married a couple years later in 2009, so I did turn it into a rental house, but the math didn't really work out. So I proceeded to lose about $400 a month for the next few years. It was a house from the 1920s, so things were always going wrong and breaking, and it wasn't well kept like for several decades probably. So it was just kind of a major issue. And the other major mistake that I made here was I let it go into foreclosure. This was a strategic foreclosure in 2012, 2013. And generally, if you ask advice from anyone from the real estate industry or outside or anyone with financial chops, they're going to tell you, you probably shouldn't let any property go into foreclosure. It's probably a really bad move. However, I think I like making big decisions. I think I also do a very good job with risk management. So this is something I looked at and I was like, fuck it. Like, I'm going to give this a try. And my credit was in the low 800s or whatever, very high. It dropped down to about 700 or 720, something like that, which is still acceptable. I did have a foreclosure, so I couldn't like buy a house for the next several years. By then, we had our feet under us and it was okay. And I felt very good about the decision. The downside was that's going to stay on your credit report for 7 years. And then the other big thing is just kind of the hassle of, you know, having folks call you. However, I'm also good at paperwork. So they called me one time and then I sent a registered letter that they can't call me anymore. So I never got a phone call again. The way it works out on paper is they forgave the mortgage. It was sold on the courthouse at the county, auctioned off as they do for foreclosures. And I had to pay taxes on the, $60,000 that was forgiven. So it ended up, I got rid of it for about $20,000. So when you do all the math, you have the headache, you have the embarrassment of foreclosure. It cost me $20,000 to get rid of $180,000 of debt. So that's a good move, but man, you had to have balls of steel, if I could say that, balls of steel to go through it for several months, and then everything turned out fine.
Yeah, you said there were two things, though, that you wanted to double down on. What was the second one?
Well, those were two. The house represented two mistakes. So it was a mistake to buy at the height, and then I let it go into foreclosure. So yeah, it was a series of mistakes over several years. Yeah.
Yeah, the house thing. I thought about real estate and I didn't want a side hustle business and all the risk. It just wasn't my thing. So I focused on investing. But the house story, God, I got one too. Yeah. I got a couple of house stories. I mean, just as Ramit Sethi says, you got to focus on the big rocks, you know, housing, cars, food, transportation, and even travel for us. But, you know, we bought our first house back in 1998 or 1999, and that was about $462,000 at the time, and we had 20% down. And a few years later, this was a 1917, just like you said, an old 100-year-old house, and we got to the point where the house needed a paint job. And so we said, okay. And then it turned from a paint job into a gut whole home rehab. I mean, we added in 2016-17, probably, you know, and money was cheap. The bank was giving away money to let you do this stuff. We overdid it, made it the probably one of the most expensive houses on our street. We added $600,000 or $700,000 of equity to it. So all of a sudden we had an over, you know, $1.1 million capitalized house. They took away our home equity line of credit because the market tanked. We were upside down where the house was only valued at $700,000 to $800,000 at the time in the real estate crash. So we were underwater. You had a foreclosure. I had a over rehab, overcapitalized house that was underwater, and we were stuck. We couldn't leave, and we had this high mortgage. I don't know. It was like $5,000 or $6,000 a month back then. It was ridiculous, and so all that money that we spent on too much house, as opposed to just enough or just big enough house, like we talked about with Sarah Suzanka on a previous episode, could have gone into investing, and it didn't. We didn't have a difference in our gap to invest. So the house, we really screwed that one up. And then later we decided to build a house, which is also a money pit. But in spite of, you know, these two mistakes, we eventually downsized and we had geo arbitrage in the meantime. So property taxes and all the costs of house ownership went down. Our salaries went up. My wife went back to work. And so we leveraged two incomes, a high savings rate, in spite of all this house stuff. Oh, and yeah, the cars. And you can have probably have a car story. We bought new cars. And we got them on debt. And my wife leased cars and I bought cars. And so we had payments out the wazoo. We didn't buy cheaper cars with cash so that we could pre-save for the next car or put the money towards investing. So, you know, if you can afford the payment, you think you can afford the item. But like Paula Pant says, you can afford anything, but not everything. And every decision, I mean, it sticks in my head. Every decision is a trade-off against something else, whether it be money related or not. And so we got the houses, the cars wrong. We loved all the travel experiences we had. We loved the rehab we did. And in the end, I don't regret being a late starter. I overcame the shame, regret, remorse, and realized that, you know what? We may have lived a YOLO life and our boat was named YOLO, but we had a lot of damn good experiences in that house with travel. You know, I kind of enjoyed the new car smell, but whatever it was, is and I wouldn't do it at 50 again. I would start at 30, 35 and, you know, save your 20, 25% and do it in a more balanced way over 20, 25 years and retire at 55. If I had it to do again and I was to reverse engineer my financial life, that's how I would do it. And that's what I encourage everybody to do because I love being work optional now. I love it. I actually enjoy my job more. So, and then what about the mistakes after you woke up and were becoming intentional about your finances and catching up? What did you make after you woke up? Because you think you're going to be perfect, but you're not.
That's a tough one. And I want to give credit to my wife who is a lot more dialed in with the finances and expenses. So there's not any huge ones that come to mind, but it's kind of the opposite. So like we did a good job keeping our head down, keeping our expenses tight. You mentioned the car stuff. I actually did the opposite. So I bought a Ford F-150 in like 2006, had it for about 16, 18 years, something like that. And I just sold it last year and I got half of what I paid for it, which is insane.
Really?
Like for,
wow.
Yeah, so, and you know, it's an old beat up truck with a V anyway. So I did like the classic, you know, old beat up truck and kept it for a really long time, but it's a mistake of a mindset shift and not doing it soon enough. So I think I did a pretty good job as I tapered down my own self-employment work, but I think we oversaved a little bit. And I think this is a common thing in the FI community. Once you get engaged with the plan, you feel really good about being frugal. You feel good seeing the number go up and you feel good about saving. And at some point, And I know a lot of people are in different stages. So if you're early on, those are great virtues, which eventually can turn into a vice unless you find the perfect kind of balance, which is always a little bit of a give and take. So the biggest mistake, I think, is like, because we've oversaved a little bit and we don't have kids, now we're in a position where we're like, okay, we actually have the leeway to spend more, but it feels wrong or we feel guilty to spend in areas where, you know, in the past we're like, oh yeah, it's fine to get the lesser of these things. Now we're moving on to like, okay, I like guitars a lot. You may not be able to see them, but there's many guitars behind me. So now I'm like, okay, I will buy a very nice guitar, even though a cheaper one will do the job. Does a nicer one make me feel better? Does it inspire me more? And everyone has a different area. So it could be health and fitness is another thing I'm passionate about. But for certain things, you can spend a whole lot more and spend a lot more effort and time in it. So perhaps a not gratifying answer, because I feel like we have dialed it in and I have learned from the people that were like 5 to 10 years ahead of me. So Carl and Mindy Jensen founded the show with me, Carl did, and learned a ton from him just seeing him a few years ahead of me, where he's like, oh, we pushed too hard. We tried to retire in 1500 days. If it was a little slower, that would have been better. So,
yeah, I mean, I think that I see that problem pretty, first of all, kudos to you, because you may think you overdid it, but you retired in your 40s. So, I mean, my God, you're still early, really. And you did it in 10 years, so kudos. But I see a lot of this flip the switch, frugal deprivation, addiction to frugality and saving. And then you get to your number, but actually, like you said, there tends to be overdoing it, a bit of hoarding. And then when you hit that peak, and then people do that so they can have a low safe withdrawal rate of 3 to 4% and tolerate the volatility of markets. And that's another day, another conversation. That's one way of strategizing against, you know, drawdowns of big numbers. But you flip the switch, and one of the themes in the movement, and you're surrounded by frugal people. You're surrounded in Longmont. So the Joneses in your area are completely different from the Joneses, say, in my neighborhood. So there's kind of some FOMO and pressure to optimize and frugalize. But then the movement is, okay, you know, Carl and Mindy are building a house. They talked to Ramit Sethi because they had a hard time flipping the switch and spending. Carl's having concerts in the backyard. And they've really made moves to say, you know what? We got to live life too. And let's rebalance, reiterate this, because it is hard. That transition to spending in retirement, once you've become kind of an addicted saver, and then dying with your highest net worth as opposed to dying with a modest net worth. I don't believe in dying with zero. I believe in the memory dividends, but I think that's a theoretical case, that dying was zero. You can't really do it. You need to have a buffer net worth at the end for longevity insurance, cognitive decline, long-term care. But it's okay to die with the same net worth you started with. What's wrong with that?
That'd be outstanding.
Yeah. You don't have to identify with money and its constant growth. And so I support that balance in accumulation and in decumulation. That's my focus now, because giving is an important part. It isn't just spending on yourself. It's spending on your 20-somethings in life, charities, all this other stuff, other uses of your money. What is it? You can have experiences, augment relationships, give, and get rid of all the shit you don't want to do, like mowing the lawn. Those are the four things that we really should be spending money on in retirement. And if we come back to me with regards to the mistakes I made after flipping the switch, I succumbed to some of the things, because one of the things I did in the great financial crisis is I sold at the bottom. I went to like bonds or 20% stocks, and my quasi-advisors in the private bank, JP Morgan, let me do it. They didn't talk me out of it. They didn't educate me otherwise. And they knew better, but they just did what I wanted because they were salespeople. And they were making money both ways, whether I bought their bonds or their stocks. So it was just, you know, that was financial malpractice. That was not fiduciary in my mind, really. Inconscionable. And so we did that. And then, so we missed out with our, you know, house poor, sold at the bottom. no gap to save. We missed out on the first third to half of that bull market that was that tailwind you and I talk about that got us there in 10 years, the luck factor, which we have to acknowledge. But along the way, I succumbed to tracking error because I was in U.S., international, and intermediate treasuries. I had kind of a bogleheads portfolio, but I watched international suffer. And I was like, people in growth stocks and all this stuff, they were flying high. And I had a Jones effect where I'm like, I'm going to rebalance into the U.S. And I did it 2 years ago. Guess what? The international took off. So I went from 40% international to 20%. And so I didn't get the full bump. I wasn't totally stupid, but I succumbed to tracking error and sold at the bottom and didn't stay the course. Stick with, the only perfect portfolio is the one you set for yourself and stick with the plan. Well, I didn't do that either, but I still got there. Yeah. And I wasn't 100% stock, so I couldn't tolerate it. I was like 80, 85, 15, so maybe I didn't get there faster. This water under the bridge, and guess what? We both still got there. We made mistakes before, during, and after, with the spending part, and we're learning from each other. You're learning from Carl and Mindy. I'm learning from people younger than me and older than me because I believe in multi-generational friendships, which is really an asset class unto itself. And I've gotten that right. I didn't screw that up.
Yeah. And we got to wrap up here because I think we could talk all day, Bill. I'll jump back and we'll say that I forgot that we have so many parallels in our financial journey. 2018, I got rid of my international stuff and I went down, I took it all the way to zero. So I didn't catch any of it. In the last year, I've actually rebalanced some per the recommendation from our advisor. So like we did basically the same thing. Kind of funny.
Then you watch people get it right. Yep. And I saw people in all growth for 15 years and they like got defy on buying all US growth. They just made the right decision, got lucky. But then guess what? Going forward, that may not be the best decision.
Yeah.
It'd be good to diversify, but I don't know. People are like 100% stocks for life, and I don't believe in that. Or 80, 20, 90, 10 with a barbell cash portfolio. I'm a diversifier. That's where I sit, and it gives me sleep factor at night. But, to each his own.
I want to finish up with the Fogify. So you mentioned in your story, you hired the advisor. They said, hey, you hit FI. I believe that was when you were about 60. It's been a couple years. You're winding down. Can you talk about that journey of like the identity shift from being a doctor? You did that for so many years, very deeply ingrained, to shifting into what you're doing now, which, you could describe that a little bit. But how's that been so far?
Yeah, I've been a doctor for 32 years. Hard to believe, really. Emergency physicians burn out faster than any physician. They get sued more than any physician. They're the most unhappy physicians. It's really interesting. On the metrics, we fail all of them. And then you go into the forums and they all want out after 10, 15, 20 years and they're looking for a way out, but they're kind of locked in. So at any rate, the fog of FI. Number one, the math worked, but the emotions didn't. It's taken time to believe the math. And I think the one-year syndrome, as I said before, is a natural process. And it's not a failure of, getting to the cliff and retiring. I get a lot of pressure from the FI movement to say, I complained about my work before. I didn't want to go. And the first thing my wife said when we were told we were FI is, you can't complain about going to work tomorrow. And so I took about 6 months to digest that. I talked to a bunch of people. I actually talked to Doc G, Jordan Grummet, in our community. And he asked the pivotal question of, is there any reason you can't cut back or quit? Can you give me one good reason? And at that time, I said no. But what I've realized in the process, and like you, is I'm a shift worker, so I can peel away shifts. I leveraged the power of FI to do a couple of things. I got a bump in pay. I got a retention bonus. And I am retiring in 3 or 4 days from night shifts. So I've cut back to 6 shifts from 10. I'm only doing day shifts. I still see value in my work as a doctor. I really do make a difference. I'm a senior physician. I see things others may not. And I love the relationships with my colleagues and staff and nurses, and my consultants. And then, you know, the patients, I get to save a life occasionally. I mean, that's not a thing to, you know, just a couple of weeks ago, I saved a guy's life. And that, maybe that wouldn't happen if I was there. I don't know. So it's hard to let go of, because your identity as a doctor, just like your identity with money, gets wrapped up in your genome or your genetics, and it's hard to unwind that. But doing so gradually is good. My plan is to work at 6 shifts till the end of next year and then reevaluate at the end of every year, and I may cut to 4. I may stay at 4 until I'm 65. I may stay at 4 longer than that, because it provides some structure, some purpose, some meaning, some value. And there's no shame in not going cold turkey like you did. You cut back gradually. And I think that's actually, in my mind, the best way to retire, if you can do it. Not everybody can do it.
Yep. Yeah. And well said too. I mean, you're doing something where you can save a life, and that obviously provides purpose. The work that I did didn't, it would be silly if I was like, wow, really the purpose was me to work on building software for a cell phone company. It's like, that's going to work out by itself. That is not saving lives at all. And when I hear people that want to keep working and they're like, well, I really just want to keep on that, you know, cell phone billing software on the back end, I'm like, there must be something better that you could do. You've done this for 15 or 20 years, but I commend you, Bill, because like that is, it's a perfect way to taper down, be true to your identity. You're helping people. There's some like mentorship and the whole community that you have been a part of. So that completely makes sense to me.
It provides financial advantage too, because I call it earning dirty money, where it's not money you need to earn, but it allows me to take that big luxurious trip. It allows me to give to my kids at a time where it matters most to them, or give to charities. And it's like Fritz Gilbert says, it gives us a chance to live like we're retired and stop saving. And you live on what you earn, and you have to get used to stopping saving. That's like the first step. And then it helps you realize, okay, I can live on this budget. It works. And my portfolio can take over that budget. And great. Then you can sort of say, cut the cord and move on to creative pursuits, giving back. You know, the world's your oyster after your work optional. It really is. That's where, you know, the second chapter of life is just robust and should be embraced. That's why we all want to get there. And that's why we want to help others get there.
Bill, this has been super fun. So we're releasing this on both sides of our podcast here. So if people want to find you, Bill, they could go check out your stuff over at Catching Up Defy, and you attend events all the time, so folks might run into you. Is there any other place that you want people to follow along?
Well, I go to Economy every year. It is a big 5 party. You get to see all your friends that you've made virtually and renew relationships. So I recommend Economy to everybody. Camp Fives are good to touch base, make new friends, see old ones. That's just the community-centered stuff. Bogleheads for me now is really fun, because Jackie and I are intimately involved and will be there this fall. And I've heard a lot of friends who have now chosen to merge Fi with Bogleheads and kind of renew it. And then the podcast is at www.catchinguptofi.com. We're found on all players. And we do have a very robust Facebook group where people get really vulnerable and ask great questions that everybody can learn from. And I throw things out that I've read or learned or listened to so that I can share it with everybody. So yeah, come on in, join the Catching Up Defy party. What about you? Tell me about where people can reach you in our community, what you're offering, and how you're giving back.
Mile High Five podcast, and it's on all the directories and on YouTube. I commend you on your Facebook group too. Like you said, very active, a lot of great messages, a lot of great people. We don't do any of that stuff. So you may find me at Camp Fies, especially Rocky Mountain. I'm always at Economy as well, hanging out around Cincinnati. You might find me at Skyline Chili, checking out the some of the fine
absolutely Cincinnati absolutely
and but in if you see me out anywhere, like, say hello. That said, I'm far less reachable than the Catching Up to Phi group, but you can send me an email and I read all of them. I don't get too many, that sort of thing. Yep, just on the podcast, and it focuses on advanced FI topics or post financial independence. So we end up talking a lot about, like, lifestyle and happiness, and I guess what do you do after you have a lot of free time? Because that's where I'm at now.
Yeah, I would say too, the thing that I haven't done yet is make the pilgrimage to Longmont, like Mecca, so that you can, you know, go to the Mr. Money Mustache Collective Collaborative, go to an, you know, go to an event there. And actually, there probably should be a big event there for people to migrate into. That's something that hasn't happened yet. And I challenge you guys to do that because, you know, there's a lot of like-minded people that we can meet by just showing up in Longmont.
Yep. I was going to say they're trying to do more events, but Bill, you have an open invitation. We could throw an event when you are in town. So just let us know.
Okay. Will do. Maybe we'll have the first Catching Up to Phi meetup in Longmont. That wouldn't be a bad idea.
Come on out. Thanks, Bill. Really appreciate it.
All right. That was fun. Thank you too.
Thanks for listening to the show. That was the Mile High Phi podcast, and I'm Doug Cunnington. If you dig the show, please do three things for us. Number one, tell a friend, a family member, an enemy about the show. We really don't care who you tell. Maybe forward them a specific show that you know that they will like. It's the single most helpful thing that you can do to spread the word. It's like giving us a virtual high five, and actually we don't give high fives in person, so the virtual kind's pretty good. And more importantly, your friend or family member or even your enemy will appreciate the fact that you were thinking of them. Number two, make sure you're following or subscribed on your podcast app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Overcast, YouTube, whatever you're using, and that way you won't miss a show. And number three, please leave us a rating and review. We read them on the show occasionally, and you might hear yours out there on an upcoming episode. Quick disclaimer, this show is not financial or legal advice. I'd actually be surprised if it sounded like it. It's really just for entertainment, and that's at least what we're hoping for. But seriously, get advice from professionals. So we'll catch y'all next week.